This is Legal Luminaries. Join us as we delve into the inspiring stories of some of the greatest legal minds to have shaped South Africa's democracy and law. I'm Imandra Petty, your guide through the series.
Welcome as we continue our foray into South Africa's justice system and the legal luminaries that have really shaped how South Africa's judiciary has defined itself and transformed over these many years. And I'm delighted today to welcome retired Chief Justice Raymond Zondo to our program as we round off what has been a spectacular odyssey. Justice Zondo, it is such a pleasure to have you with us. And can you believe you are still in so much demand? You are not being allowed to just retire in peace. Welcome.
Yes, it's like of late a number of organizations just shared information that I'm now available and I'm getting lots of invitations.
Yeah, and it is important, I think, bearing in mind what you've just said about those invitations, that we keep you very connected to commentary in the space, because I don't think anyone has quite a unique perspective as you and perhaps your other retired chief justices and deputy chief justices as to how the South African judicial landscape actually works and functions. And we'll touch on some of those highlights in just a moment. But you've had a very long and illustrious career. I mean, you're dealing with so many different aspects of South African judicial life, dealing with the State Capture Commission, which is widely reported on, being in the Constitutional Court, the Labour and Labour Appeal Courts. Your contributions to legal reform and to human rights has been prolific. And it's always nice to ask the person who is at the centre of all of this what you believe for yourself has been the most significant legal development or ruling that has shaped the judiciary during your jurisdiction.
Well, of course, there are many, but one that I regard as really very important for the role of the judiciary in our constitutional democracy, for me, has to be the judgment of the Constitutional Court in both matters involving the State Capture Commission and former President Zuma. And maybe the second one, namely the contempt of court one, maybe more than the first one, where an order was made for him to appear before the commission. The reason for me why the second one, the contempt of court one, is so important is that it affirmed something very important for our constitutional democracy, namely that we are all equal before the law. So when you do something, when you break the law, when you defy an order of court, what gets done if you are John, if you are Sipho, if you are Temba, if you are Nomsa, if you are whoever, is the same that will be done to a former president, to a sitting president, to any people who are in high office. And also the message that the Constitutional Court sent to society through that judgment, namely that the judiciary would not be bullied, the judiciary would not be intimidated by anybody in carrying out its functions. Now, that goes to the fundamentals of our constitutional democracy. And I think that it's a judgment that for centuries to come will be referred to as showing what kind of society we are, what kind of constitutional democracy we are, and what kind of judiciary South Africa has.
And I think it's a really important point around the concept of access to justice in a society or societies around the world where we often say the deeper the pockets, the more access and the wider the gates to justice are. But what you're saying is that in the South African experience, the opposite is true, where it doesn't matter where you are or who you are. In principle, those doors are open. Of course, there are complexities around legal counsel and access to the best counsel and so on, which has a complicating factor. When you look back in hindsight, Justice Zondo, and you've chosen to begin our interview then with that example that really affected South Africa, both from a legal perspective and a social political perspective, we saw after that contempt of court order, defying a lawful order, the sentence to 15 months in prison, the first time in a democratic South Africa that a former president was jailed, and all of the events that flowed out of it, how do you measure the wisdom of that decision against what happened after?
Well, there is no doubt that that was the correct decision to be made. And it would remain, as far as I'm concerned, the correct decision to make if the same facts were to arise. Because imagine if the judiciary had failed to rise to the occasion, if the judiciary had been intimidated, if the judiciary had feared to give the correct decision, what would happen to our legal system? Because after that, what would the judiciary do if anybody defied orders of court? Because they would say, you allowed so and so. So are there two legal systems in this country, one for some and another one for others? We would simply never have been able after that to have any legal system that has credibility. And that's very important. Of course, what happened was tragic. Lives were lost, but that was not the job of the judiciary. The executive had to make sure that lives were not lost, property was not destroyed. They had been informed long in advance. Threats had been made. They should have been ready. And from what we saw, either they were not ready, or someone got the perception maybe where didn't have their loyalty where it was supposed to be, namely with the state and with keeping law and order. I've said publicly before, some of those days, it was just so quiet. And one began to wonder whether what was happening was a coup in progress, because one could not see the president addressing the nation about this. One could not see the minister of police. One could not see the minister of defense, anybody saying it. And yet, the country was basically on fire. So it was very concerning. And what is important, however, is whether there are any lessons that we as a country learned from that episode, and whether there are any lessons that the executive learned from that episode, whether if we were to have the same thing, they would be ready to handle the situation more effectively than before. I don't know if they will be, but maybe they do have a plan that I'm not aware of. So it's very important that where we have not done the right thing in the past, we learn from our lessons and we get ready to make sure that going forward, we will do better.
I think what stands out from what you are saying is this dogged separation of powers between the judiciary and the executive, because you are saying, and what you just said is, we have done and fulfilled our responsibility and our mandate. It is up to the other arms of government and the state to fulfill their roles and their duties. Like, you can't be thinking about the what next. We've got to think about what's in our ambit of responsibility and control. Would that be the right characterization?
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. That is correct. Because we have to assume that they will do their part. And if they don't do their part, of course, then something like what happened in 2021 will happen, you know. But for me, the decision taken by the Constitutional Court on that occasion really made me proud of our judiciary.
Where do things stand? I mean, I think, and maybe, you know, there's a comfortability now to ask you this, although you have been asked this before. Where do things stand between yourself and former President Jacob Zuma now?
Well, I'm aware that he still speaks, complains about me in public from time to time. I am aware that he gave an interview, I think it was to Newsroom Africa sometime last year, where he was asked the question whether he was still angry about what happened. And he said he was, whether it was angry or bitter, I can't remember, but he was angry and he said he would be angry until he dies. And I'm aware that recently when MK party members went to court, when his daughter was appearing in court, he he spoke and referred to my name again. So I'm aware of those things. We haven't spoken. We saw each other at the funeral of the former IFP president, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, last year sometime. And he just greeted in general, and I greeted back in general. But we have never met again or spoken to each other again.
Let's bring things back again, back to the bench. We've seen now, Justice Zondo, the rise of a number of different competing interests in a country as diverse and historically fraught as South Africa. How do you approach ensuring, or how did you during your tenure, that the judiciary remains independent? You've in part, I think, explained that through this really fraught example you've shared with us. But remaining independent, especially when you've got pressure from politics, from the media, and from public opinion.
Well, the greatest way of ensuring that the judiciary remains independent is ensuring that people who get appointed as judges and magistrates are people who have integrity, people who will respect their oath of office that says they will administer justice to everyone without fear, favor, or prejudice. That is critical to personal independence of the judiciary. That is the first thing. The second thing is, of course, to ensure that where there are suspicions that judges have done wrong or that they have not shown integrity, that there are mechanisms to hold them accountable. And as you know, in South Africa, we do have those mechanisms. We do have the Judicial Conduct Committee that deals with complaints against judges. And fortunately, we are able to say the way the judiciary deals with complaints against judges is still a way in which they show their independence. Because where they find that there is evidence of gross misconduct, they have not shied away from saying that judge must be removed from the bench. We know that there are some judges who have been removed, and there may be others who might be removed in the future. So that is also important to ensure that judges remain independent and they act in accordance with integrity. Of course, then you also need to look at resources that are made available to the judges in order for them to do their job properly and independently. And that those are very important as well. But as you know, as Chief Justice, I also spoke publicly a lot about the importance of the independence of the judiciary and about judges deciding cases in accordance with their oath of office and in accordance with the Constitution and the law and the evidence before them. And so far, I think that the judiciary of South Africa is doing very well. I know that there are people who make all kinds of accusations against the judiciary, saying they are captured or whatever, but it's nonsense. It's got no evidence. It just suits them to have people looking at the judiciary as if it's done anything wrong. They have been invited many times to come up with evidence. They have no evidence. And those accusations just need not be given any life anymore.
Very, very important. Very important point, because you want a judiciary that stands head and shoulders above, as the image depicts, you know, blind to who justice has been meted out to, and those scales are very intentionally balanced.
Yes.
You know, one of the important things, and I think you see this as a challenge in academic circles, is the rise of AI and the impact on academia. How do you foresee the role of AI and digital tools in the courtroom, and what steps should the judiciary be taking to adapt?
Well, I doubt that we as the judiciary at that level as yet. Well, the judiciary is known to be slow in regard to certain things. But there is no doubt that just like everybody in society, the judiciary will also have to adapt and to look at AI and see how it can best be used to make sure that access to justice is facilitated and that access to justice is cost effective and so on. and that it's not too expensive, because those are very important things in terms of access to justice, the costs, the how it is facilitated, and how cases are decided speedily. Now, I know that there are two professors. One of them is Professor Mpeti, the Vice Chancellor of the University of Johannesburg, who have written a book on law and AI. I haven't read the book, so I'm not sure what they may be proposing. But I have no doubt that the current leadership of the judiciary will be looking at AI and looking to see how it can be used in order to make sure that we provide a better justice system to the people. You would be aware of the digitization program that the judiciary has been on for quite a long time. When I was interviewed for the position of Chief Justice, I talked about that, and I think Judge President Lambo also spoke about that. By the time I retired in August, we had made quite a lot of progress in terms of covering various courts, because that program started as a pilot in Gauteng, but it was moving beyond that. It was going to the Supreme Court of Appeal, the Constitutional Court, as well as the high courts as well. We had a timetable which was going to be followed. So I've no doubt that with regard to AI as well, the judiciary will look at how best it can be used to make sure that we provide an improved service to the people.
You know, you mentioned Judge President Dunstan Mlambo, and one of the ways to deal with, you know, and this is chronic, the backlogs in court and the court role is to go the route of mediation for civil cases. I'm wondering if AI might have a role to play. Obviously not now. That would have to be evaluated later in speeding up the settling of claims. Maybe just a quick comment on that as a route to go. There has been some debate about whether it will ultimately stop people waiting 5 years in medical negligence or in RAF cases.
Well, it's a good idea, but it's not something that is new. It has been tried before. My recollection is that the challenge before was that quite often the litigants were saying, who is going to pay for the mediator? Because the mediator has to be paid. And there was at some stage a debate about whether the state should employ mediators. And I think there were challenges about that. So that is part of what seemed to have been a problem in the past. I don't know now whether it is not going to be a problem, because my understanding is that it is still a situation where the parties must pay for the mediator. Obviously, with some parties, it should not be a problem. But with a lot of parties, it might be a problem. And of course, parties would think about the fact that, well, if mediation fails, they still have to continue with courts. So it's something that is worth trying, particularly in these times where, according to Judge President Mlambo, they are trying to ensure that people don't have to wait for years when they are ready to have a trial. They have to wait for years because there are not enough judges and there are not enough courtrooms. And that is something that even during my time as Chief Justice, I was dealing with. The Labor Court had the similar problem for years, and we were bringing this to the attention of the executive and saying there must be more courtrooms, must be more judges, so we must create more posts, but it was simply not being done. And I hear that there was the Mosenega Committee, which was looking at the establishment, judicial establishments, which is really about how many judges each court should have. But that should not be something to use as an excuse when there are clear cases where there should be more judges, because you can see the workload and you can see that whatever the Mosenega Committee is saying, it can't say we mustn't employ more. You know, so you should go ahead, because the need is there. Go ahead and appoint those judges who can be appointed. Maybe when you reach a point where you say, well, maybe this is going to be excessive, maybe we don't need many, then you can wait for the committee's recommendations.
I want to move on to the issue, or really the concept, of institutional memory and intergenerational knowledge transfer, Justice Zondo. How do you see the relationship between the judiciary and legal education, especially when we think about empowering young legal professionals, a lot of whom will be listening to our conversation with great interest? How can this initiative, an initiative like Legal Luminaries, contribute to this?
Well, it can contribute quite immensely. On the one hand, talking about the judiciary and education, as you would know, we've got SIJ, the Institute for Judicial Education, where judges and magistrates get ongoing continuing education to try and make sure that they are better armed to deal with cases. But apart from that, I think that particularly those judges like me who are retired should make time to assist young lawyers and young judges who might need assistance. And actually, it's a very interesting subject because I'm hoping that one day one might be able to have an arrangement in terms of which maybe twice a year one brings together retired judges and experienced judges and retired senior lawyers or available senior lawyers to help recently admitted attorneys and advocates or law graduates, just to train them on practicals and train them on how to handle cases, but also on ethics. Because sometimes we see lawyers who don't seem, some of the lawyers we see don't seem to understand their mandate or their job, which is your job as a counsel, a job as an attorney, a legal representative, is on behalf of your client to persuade the court to your client's view. It's not to fight with the court. It's to try and persuade the court, you know, and not to disrespect the judge, the presiding officer, but to know that it's in your client's interest to persuade. And that's the main task.
Do any incidents stand out in your mind of where it felt like somebody was playing, you know, playing the man and not the ball in your court, playing you and not the issue?
Not in court as such that I can remember, but there are well-known instances that happened in the commission. So,
and of course, the commission's work insofar as its findings and those highlight moments, I think, are there within the public purview. They are.
Yes.
I want to start wrapping this by just asking you for a reflection across these many years as a legal practitioner, how you balance the need to create legal consistency, because that also creates certainty and a sense of codification on the one hand, but also awareness that the law is a living, breathing thing. Social values change. The demands on the law changes. You know, so how did you do that? How did you create balance and consistency?
Well, I mean, you touch on a very important subject, because if you want certainty, it's easy to say, let's have codification, but you might lose fairness in the process. So in order to balance the two, it's important that public policy in terms of the values of society, and in our context, those values are embodied in our constitution, that they be taken into account all the time as one interprets legislation and the constitution. So that is the way to do it. Obviously, it doesn't create absolute certainty. And of course, it can create absolute fairness. But hopefully, what the courts try and do is to strike that balance. And of course, not everybody will agree that they strike that balance correctly all the time. But certainly, they make an effort.
I want to close. And if I'm right, Justice Zondo, May 4th is your birthday, because it's my birthday.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes.
Two great Koreans.
Oh, I didn't know that that's your birthday too. Yes, the 4th of May is my birthday.
And what's also interesting is we both grew up in KwaZulu-Natal, as did you. You grew up in Ikopo and in KZN.
Yes.
Studied at UniZul as well as UKZN. But I think what's beautiful to remember historically is in the 1980s, you were a clerk and researcher for Victoria Mxenge. We know that she was tragically assassinated. And I'd like just a memory or two from you about those seminal years during a time when it was risky in a way to be a Black lawyer and also to seek career mobility and then to encounter these amazing, inspirational and historic figures in South Africa's political history.
Yes. Well, I unfortunately never met Mr. Griffiths Mxenge before he passed on, but obviously I knew of him, and I certainly was articled to Mrs. Mxenge. She inspired me greatly. She made me to have confidence in myself. She made me feel that if I worked hard, I could be a successful lawyer. And she did that in part by entrusting to me at a time when I was just really a candidate attorney, as an article clerk, a whole labor law department that the firm was starting, because she said, this labor law thing is a new thing. A lot of us don't know it, but it's very important. We want to have such a department here. You have had some exposure at the Legal Resource Center to labor law. You start it. I will give you a big office. I'll give you a secretary. And usually a clerk will not be given a secretary of his or her own. And a big office, because you will consult with a lot of workers. But you must look out for experienced labor lawyers who can guide you as to what to do. And looking back, I think that is what launched my labor law career. Because in the end, I think I got onto the bench because of mainly my labor law experience. And then, of course, I had general experience as well. But when I look back, I think that she played a very critical role. And as you might be aware, at my farewell dinner, I paid tribute to her, and I had invited some of her children to join us for that dinner just to celebrate the impact that she made in my life. So those were very inspirational figures indeed.
And that was an incredible night of reflection, and the people who are the early investors and the first believers in a career that would turn up to be as illustrious as yours. It's also a page out of a judge's diary on the importance of mentorship. So we're happy that you had those mentors who were able to then steer you in the direction in which you've gone. A closing thought from you, Justice Zondo?
My closing thought is that I wish that our judiciary continues to play the role that it is supposed to play in our constitutional democracy. I wish that they be given all the resources they need to do their job properly and to ensure access to justice. And I wish that the executive will move faster in ensuring that the judiciary gets what we call institutional independence. And I hope that the South Africans will continue to appreciate the role of the judiciary in our constitutional democracy and will defend the judiciary when it is attacked without any basis. Thank you.
Justice Raymond Zondo, it's been a special privilege to be able to interview you again. Thank you so much for your time today. And hopefully at some point you get to do your gardening finally.
Thank you. I hope so. And my wife hopes so as well, because so far I've not started. No, thank you very much.
And happy birthday in advance.
Happy birthday. Thank you. Happy birthday to you in advance too. Thank you very much.
Take care, Justice Zondo.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Legal Luminaries, a Jackpod original podcast by Duta and Jacaranda FM. I'm Imandra Petty. Find more episodes at jacarandafm.com. Just click on Jackpod.